And I noticed that when we center Palestine in our immediate relationships, I feel the ripples of change. I feel the ripples of solidarity, and I feel the fabric of community around me gaining more insight, more care, more fierce solidarity. And if I can, that's what that's the tool, that's the weapon I have. It's the one I know how to use. And so in me, in this body, in this life, that what is what I feel I can do. And I believe in the ripples. I don't believe that my art can change things, huge violent empires and their bombs. But I think that I can change the fabric of those who surround me and send those ripples out. And I believe that the artists that have, I mean, there's so many artists that have rippled into me with their ideas and their thoughts. And so I know it's true because I've changed from that. And I've changed, how I live and who I am and what I say and what I do because of the ripples of others. So I think artistic work can't hold everything. It can't comprehend everything, but it can make ripples in you and around you that keep going. And that's what I think I can do and know for sure it's working. And then there's things you can't see. There's ripples that you never see. You never know what kind of impact falls out of a moment. I think also as a Palestinian artist at this time, what I do think is that I need my arts to process what I'm seeing and what I've felt. And it's the thing I can't do and then the only thing I can do. So the next show we're making is called After the Last Red Sky. And it references Mahmoud Darwish, who writes, "Where do the birds fly after the last sky?" And it's a question of exile. If there's no sky, where do the birds go? We proposed this show a year ago before October 7th, but then we wanted to make this whole show about the question of the Palestinian sky and what does the sky mean in Palestine? And what does it feel like in Palestine? And it was a similar question of the borders of the sky, of this airspace, that airspace, who's allowed to move, what is in the sky, and who gets to look up at a sky that doesn't threaten to kill you, because some people, even like many parts of the world, you can live with a sky that rains and snows and birds and clouds. But in Palestine and in other places where there's drones and bombs falling, what does the sky mean there? It also started with this Palestinian folk story, which we read, which is about if there's a lunar eclipse, then it means, in Palestinian folk belief, it means that a whale is eating the moon. And so the children should run outside, bang on pots and pans, and scream as loud as they can, "Oh, whale, don't eat our moon." So we at first imagined like, whoa, that's such an amazing folk belief. Like, let's bang on pots and pans and scream at the moon and scream at the whale and just scream, allow ourselves to scream. And that's when the rock show idea started. But then also we were like, how does that screaming at the sky take shape in other contexts where you would want to scream to stop something happening in the sky, stop bombs falling, stop the drones, stop the surveillance, So I think the whole concept is kind of like, what is the Palestinian sky? And can you scream at the sky and make something stop?
In some countries, there were people who had 100 handbags, people who hired maids to take care of their maids. You could float down the Rhine and see castles. Dogs wore coats for daily walks in Central Park. A dog's diamond collar glistened. We were not dreaming of these things for ourselves. We needed basics, starting small. Hello? You look like a human being to me. It's hard to know what open roads mean if you've always had them. We can't imagine the luxury of open roads.
arrived to Boston, not on a boat, on a plane. And I recall the day I flew over the Charles River. It was like all icy in January 1996. And immediately I felt like that's a new place for me. That's a new country. It was the first time I leave my family behind, my parents, my siblings. But I felt like this is a new start for me. And it was. And I have spent half of my life up to this date in this country. Sometimes, not every day, but every month or every week, I feel I'm crossing a border, whether it's about my national origin or language or accent. It's always omnipresent, that idea that I don't totally belong, even though I've spent half of my life here. I'm always reminded that I still have an accent. It makes me sometimes feel less than full American. And at least in the first 10, 15 years, I felt like maybe there is a glass ceiling one cannot pass, right? And even every time I pass one glass ceiling, I feel like maybe there's another, even though the technical part or the way I supervise or I manage may be liked by people, but maybe my accent may make some people think, well, this guy may not represent us well, right? So I feel the borders every day.
On another occasion, I'm in Somalia. Lots of death because of famine and war and drought, killing people by the hundreds every day. So I was going to go from one zone to another zone. Each zone was controlled by a different clan, and there was a lot of fighting, and nobody liked each other. So I got a pass from the person in the zone to which I was going, and it said, allow this man to go into this place. And then he told me how much I would pay. He said, you have to pay $50. Then you give him this, you show him this, and you can go. So I got to the border spot or the clan dividing line, and they stopped me. They wanted more money. I could have easily paid them more money, but I said, no, this is my paper. Your boss gave me this paper. It says $50 and I can go. No. They were making they could have shot me or something. And nobody would have found me for a couple of months. I can't call for help. Finally, I said, here's your $50. This is the paper. And here's $10 tip. And now I'm going. Bye. Thank you very much. And they didn't do anything. I just went right on through. The point of that story really is that those are the stories you remember because they're so different. But when things are smooth and nothing happens, you basically don't remember that. You forget about it.
There are the official borders that you cannot legally cross. And then there are borders that legally you have every right to be there, but you're not safe. The drag laws are not actually aimed at me, but I am technically illegal in a lot of places in the country right now. And again, I know who they're enforcing it against, and they're not enforcing it against people who look like me, but it is still a pretty clear signal about not being one in. And again, I think about, what if you get sick? There's a kind of classic healthcare fear with trans people about any kind of health emergency where our clothes get taken off. And when people see a discrepant body, how is that going to happen? So one of my aunts lives in this very small town in Texas, and I have pretty much refused to go there. So I have seen my aunt when she's come to San Francisco. I have not visited her there. So a couple years ago, this aunt and her husband were visiting. And I had been thinking about how I think they think the reason I don't want to go to their small town is because I'm a snob. Because I'm a liberal elite from the big city and I think their small town is boring. And actually, the reason I don't want to go to their small town is because I feel like I might die. So they were visiting my folks. So I found a moment when she was alone in the kitchen because I didn't want everybody to be around. And I just wanted to have like a short, frank conversation with her. And I just start explaining, Ginny, I just really want you to know I appreciate your hospitality. I love your offers to invite me to your house. It's a beautiful house. The reason I'm not going is not anything personal about you. It's because I feel unsafe in that town. I think, you know, what if I needed medical care? There aren't laws in place to protect me. Would I be able to get treatment? What would happen to somebody like me going into a hospital? So my aunt says it would be fine. One of the nurses at the hospital goes to my church. I would get her to treat you, which is super sweet and kind of not the point, but super sweet. This is the great thing. My uncle says, don't worry, I have a gun. If you were sick and you needed health care, I would threaten to shoot someone unless they gave you health care. This is probably the most endearing thing that uncle has ever done.
To Live in the Borderlands by Gloria Anzaldúa. To live in the borderlands means you are neither Hispana, India, Negra, Española, ni Gabacha. Eres mestiza, mulata, half-breed, caught in the crossfire between camps while carrying all five races on your back, not knowing which side to turn to, run from. To live in the borderlands means knowing that the Indian in you betrayed for 500 years is no longer speaking to you. The Mexicanas called you rajetas. That denying the Anglo inside you is as bad as having denied the Indian or black. Cuando vives en la frontera, people walk through you. The wind steals your voice. You're a burra, buey, scapegoat, forerunner of a new race. Half and half both woman and man, neither a new gender. To live in the borderlands means to put chile in the borscht, eat whole wet tortillas, speak Tex-Mex with a Brooklyn accent, be stopped by La Migra at the border checkpoints. Living in the borderlands means you fight hard to resist the gold elixir beckoning from the bottle, the pull of the gun barrel, the rope crushing the hollow of your throat. In the borderlands you are the battleground where enemies are keen to each other. You are at home, a stranger. The border disputes have been settled, the volley of shots have scattered the truce. You are wounded, lost in action, dead, fighting back. To live in the borderlands means the mill with the razor white teeth wants to shred off your olive red skin. Crush out the kernel, your heart pounds you, pinch you, roll you out, smelling like white breath but death. To survive the borderlands, you must live sin fronteras, be a crossroads.
Aniap Chugi, Nellie David. My name is Nellie David. I come from Ajo, Arizona. I want to start by giving thanks to Ohlone ancestors and relatives who are from this area, and also thanks to the Islamic Cultural Center for having me here. My mother is Otham, and my father is white. And so growing up, I had this very unique experience of noticing, even before I knew what racism was, before I knew what discrimination was, anything, I noticed that my parents were treated differently. Our experiences were different, and my mother, who was indigenous to the area, was often treated by the colonial regime as an outsider, as if she didn't belong, whereas my father, who was white, was often treated as if he belonged. And, you know, as a kid, that didn't make any sense to me at all. You know, I knew where my mom was from, and she was from right there, and so why is she being treated differently? So the more I learned about Palestine, the more this light bulb went off in my head, like, oh my gosh, the parallels. There are so many parallels. Our culture is very different. I mean, we have in a beautiful way, we have our own language, we have our own customs, we have our own beliefs, but in how things are imposed on us, things are very similar in how militarization is imposed on us, borders, checkpoints, treatment as another person. When I first got to Palestine, it was just like, wow, this is like a parallel universe. We're on the other side of the world, but yet things are so similar in a lot of ways. And I identified a lot with Palestinians in that way. Hiatshet Atam means sand people. Dono Atam means desert, people. And Akimel Atam means river people. And we are all the same people, but we've been separated by our colonial borders, by federal recognition, by colonialism, by many things. But we are all one people, and we all speak the same language. And my goal, our goal, the goal of many of us, is to reconnect Atam who have been separated by these colonial entities. We go way, way down into Mexico, way down, touching the Gulf of California, up to Phoenix area. That's where our Akimel Atam relatives, the river people, are. But, you know, our traditional area is huge. It's like all-encompassing. But this is our piece of land where we are at today. It's roughly the size of Connecticut, so we are a large reservation, and we are a very large group of indigenous people that still exist. And I grew up in a very intersectional reality. A lot of my friends were from Mexico. A lot of my friends were also from the reservation, and I'm Atam. And so that was my existence. I didn't really know anything else except for, you know, that multicultural existence. So you can imagine how these world events has really brought to light, you know, how things are, you know, outside of my tiny town. My sister and I, and we were traveling freely as we once did. Being from the small town that we are, it's in the middle of the desert, in the middle of nowhere. Closest cities are Phoenix and Tucson and Sonoita. So everybody either goes to one of those places to get supplies. And so this is how I grew up. Every weekend, we were in the back of the camper reading books, and we would go back and forth, and we would get supplies. But after September 11th, this reality no longer exists. We will never, my kids, if I have kids, I hope I have kids, if I have kids, they will never know the freedom that we knew to travel back and forth. Because now we have to go through checkpoints. And they're not checkpoints on the border. They're checkpoints inland. Yeah, my mother has to go across every time she wants to visit me. I have to go every time I have to visit her. And we do have our citizenship question. And we do get questioned more the darker our skin is. The creation of Homeland Security pretty much developed after 9/11. And we saw an explosion of Border Patrol, unprecedented numbers. And I was pretty much normalized to it when I was little. I thought that was my reality. I was normalized to migrants coming through. Fortunately, I was normalized to migrants dying all the time because it was the 90s. And that was the period when they were funneling through, and they had this prevention through deterrence policy where they were closing off the border through walls and other means, and had this intentional policy of deterring them through Atam land, knowing that many immigrants would die, and with the intention in mind that that would scare them off and deter them from crossing the border. I believe we're the only reservation that has a checkpoint to get to the other side of the reservation, because there's San Javier Reservation, and it's on a separate location than our main part of the reservation, so we have to go through a checkpoint just to go to the other side of our own people. And I mean, that's in addition to having to go through a checkpoint across to Mexico, because we are in Mexico. We have Atam in Mexico, and they have a lot of their own issues. On all sides, we are all experiencing various issues from border militarization. Atam in Mexico often have trouble accessing health care. It's very remote. They get treated very badly on this side, even though they are told that they should have have rights as they are members of the tribe, but that's in reality, that's not really how it is. And then up in Akamel Otham territory, they have the Loop 202 freeway coming through, and that is all connected to militarization because they want to make the corridor nice and militarized so they can get their goods to come through. So they're building freeways, they're building more and more structures on indigenous land, and it directly affects us by the checkpoints, by the presence of agents and officials just basically everywhere we go. They're everywhere. So that really got me into the activism that I was in. I'd been reading up on Palestine for years, and then I got this opportunity to go with the World Without Walls delegation. And at first I didn't want to go because, I mean, I was still dealing with the trauma from the border here. And it was just like, why would I want to go see more trauma when I'm still trying to cope with this? I still haven't healed with, you know, all that I've seen. But this was just, I mean, it was spiritual in so many ways. This was such an amazing group. I love you guys. I love that I'm here. So I think this was our first day in Jerusalem. That's with Ali. And he was telling us about how Black Palestinians are discriminated in Israel. And so, I mean, there's just so many similarities to draw from in how, like was said before, in how police states just crack down on minorities, and they criminalize people of color, and you know, our existence is just questioned all the time, and it's pretty mind-blowing how across the world it can be so similar in so many ways. So one of the things that that we've been thinking about in our delegation a lot is how, you know, how many lies there are that perpetuate in the media and everything else, and how that affects us as people. And here we see it in everything. There's Westerners, there's you know, Landa Lakes butter, all these things, all these cartoons, you know, and they don't tell the right story. And so people have this false portrayal and false image, or they think of indigenous people as existing in the past and not in the present. And we're still here. So, you know, we have this monumental task of telling the truth. And the same with Palestine. You know, in Jericho, we had this experience where we were feeling the solidarity and just loving it, like the vibes and everything else in Palestine. But then we got, you know, a speaker that kind of equated our solidarity and everything to wonderful USA and how lovely it all is and how this is this melting pot where we could just come together. And the indigenous folks, you know, the Otham folks on that trip were just like, oh, we were with you until you said that. And it was really hurtful. It was really hurtful, but thinking about it the other way, I mean, how do we think about Palestinians? How are Palestinians portrayed in the media? A lot of people on the reservation who have never been outside the reservation, their first introduction to Palestine is through colonialism, it's through the television. And so we both have work to do, and all of our cultures have work to do looking at each other through outside the lens of colonization. That's why we need to be speaking to each other, talking to each other as much as we can. So I wanted to also forge a similarity between when we were in the Jordan Valley, and we were shown these canals, which are now dry, because farmers and agriculture had been existing there for historical, since time immemorial. And then colonization comes along, and the Israelis come, and they pump the water, and all of a sudden, the farmers don't have water anymore. And I was thinking, you know, we as Otham are so far removed from our history because we had the same thing happen, yet we're not giving people tours of it. I think it's important to remember that we shouldn't forget these things. And water's life. We need water to survive. We need water for everything. And so it really shows, you know, how our movements really do connect with each other, because we all have the same elements. We are all in the same struggle. Lastly, I wanted to touch on Elbit towers that are currently being put up on the reservation very quietly. They've been happening for several years now. It started under the Obama administration. And unfortunately, they're using the wall as a further excuse to push the towers on us. And our administration is complying because there's so much pressure on us. And there are very many of us who are opposed to the towers. They're causing environmental distress. They spy on the homes of people. Border Patrol often cut through people's homes. They cut fences. They don't respect people at all. They kill our people. Actually, we've had OTM members run over by Border Patrol, and that is often covered up. Our Bennett Patricio's mother was ran off the reservation after her son was killed by Border Patrol officer. And they will do everything they can to keep you quiet, and it's scary. These towers will go up to 175 feet into the air. Big eyesore, they emit microwave radiation. We live in a pristine, beautiful desert, and a lot of our wildlife rely on their migration patterns, birds, bats, bees. They need their navigational senses, and there really aren't that many studies that demonstrate the harms that we could experience by these towers. But they're telling us that they're harmless, and we don't believe it, largely due to the fact that they have lied about everything that they've done. They said that Border Patrol encroachment wouldn't harm our land before, and here we have roads, we have species that are dying out, you know, so we know that it's not, they're not telling the truth when they find that there's going to be no significant impact. There is a huge impact to us, and we are feeling that impact. It's really scary. It's really scary to think about, and it's my life mission to stop these towers. And if they're put on, it'll be my life mission to get rid of them. And they tell us the good thing about it, because we're always complaining about militarization. We have so many complaints on Border Patrol. It is not even funny, and they don't do anything about it. Their response is, well, the towers will be to your benefit because we'll have less military personnel out there and they won't be harassing you so much. And so it's like this kind of feeling of hopelessness. But the good thing, the great thing that is coming out of all the bad is that people are becoming aware that others have our backs, you know, that it's not just us alone in the world being militarized, that it's happening all over, and that's not a good thing, but the good thing is that we are connected, and, you know, we can connect with each other and learn, you know, each other's movements just like they're doing to us. We, you know, we can win this. We can. But there's more of us. There's more of us at the bottom of the pyramid. There's so many more of us, and it's, to me, it's almost silly that, you know, that they have so much power. When here we are, you know, there's so many of us, and we have the power right here in our hands if we can connect with each other and learn from each other and just do it.
Thank you for listening to part 6 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors. Or do they? The poem Affirmation, written by Asada Shakur, was read by Samantha Rogers and Lujain Asale. Carla Cisneros read Gloria Anzaldúa's poem Borderland. Joseph Young read Open Roads, a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye. Bassam, Nabil, and Mr. Liu shared some of their personal border stories. Music by Jamie Branch, Rai Cooter, Sarah Hopkins, Kate Laban, and Mike Reed. We want to thank Ilaria Gilioli, Leila Awadalla, and Nellie Jo David for their willingness to be part of this program. This show was produced by Emily Charles and Mary Salome, a Queer in Your Ear production.